Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Go Global Fast, where globalization and cultural awareness meet heart and soul. Come along and gain practical insights about how to deal with many cultures at once with sensitivity and grace. And here are the hosts of Go Global Fast, Dr. Tayera Kobayeva and Deborah Brown.
Yes, indeed. Here we are, and we're going to have a wonderful conversation. This is Deborah Brown, and Dr. Tayera Kobayeva is on the other line. Give us a say hello, Dr. Tayera Kobayeva, my darling friend.
Dr. Tayera Kobayeva is reporting on duty. So here she is.
That's so cool. I love this. I love the way we can connect, even though I'm not even at my home station, so to speak. I'm visiting in Arkansas, and you're where you live, and we can still be on this call. And if that's not going global fast, I don't know what is. And I think that's one of the most amazing things about how small the world really is when you think in terms of technology. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. More than that, you will be connecting with me soon from Turkey. And because I'm going to be in Turkey in several weeks, and then you will be connecting with me, or we will be connecting with others in Ukraine and Russia. And
I am so excited about that, because it has not been that long ago that we would have never been able to do this. I just am blown away by the ease and simplicity of simply picking up the phone and being able to have a high-level conversation with people all around the world, and we just keep going on the things that are of interest to us. And I'm so grateful, I guess, really, that we can do that.
You know, it has many, many more implications than one. And I would like to share with you what it meant to me. For example, when I was leaving the Soviet Union, I thought, as the previous generation of immigrants did, that I am leaving these places and I will never see them again. I will never see the people again. That's it. My previous incarnation, so to say, is cut off, and I'm starting a new incarnation altogether. It had a sense of doom and gloom in my heart because, you know, leaving your native land is never easy. Never, never, because you're leaving your biological mother and you're going to your adoptive mother, and you don't know what your adoptive mother is going to do to you or with you. And the first 10 years of my life in the United States, in Europe, and in the United States were exactly that. I thought that I left everybody behind. I will never reconnect with everybody. And there was a sense of distance and irrevocability of our relationship. And lo and behold, Facebook shows up. And now, not only I see my childhood photos on my relatives' pages, all of them are there. And I did not even know that they were there. In fact, when I first started communicating with them on Facebook, I was so confused because I was used to Facebook is America, and therefore you use English. And so I would inadvertently write to them in English, and they will get back angry and say, for goodness sakes, did you forget your native tongue? And I would forget because Facebook and them do not coincide in my mind. These were two totally different entities. And I connected with everybody because of Facebook. I found people I went to school with when I was 7. It was in Nizhny Novgorod. In Nizhny Novgorod in Russia at that time was a classified place. I could not even go back and visit. Lo and behold, now we're all connected. Talk about globalization. No question about it.
It is amazing. It's really so much bigger for people who have traveled or like you have, you know, immigrated to another country. It's not just what I had for lunch and, you know, where my kids are going to go to the beach and, you know, pictures and things like that. It really is an opportunity to, like you're saying, connect with family and friends that you might not see again anytime soon. But it's also, and I don't want to be negative, but it's also where revolutions have kind of fomented, if you will, you know, like the thing that happened in Egypt and, you know, when you think about that, that's quite a globalization story right there, that they can actually start a riot, so to speak, in an entire country and overthrow a government in these places. So what do you think about that?
You know, political events are, on the one hand, are difficult for me to comment on, and the reason being is because something of a former professional in me pops up and wants to be very, very cautious. But I would like to overpress my caution, and I would like to go on the record and tell you what I really think. We really got connected in more ways than one, and the role of official politics and diplomacy went down dramatically, and the role of direct communication with people went up exponentially and will continue to go up. So official diplomacy plays, in my view, less and less role in how we are going to shape up in the future. And the role of our informal relationships is going up and up and up and up. And let me give you an example. I was at a speaking event several weeks ago. It was at Coronado Island. And I met a reasonably famous guy who was on X Factor in Australia. And he was one of my fellow speakers there. And he was found in a shoebox in Iraq. And he was adopted later, together with his brother, who was found in the same shoebox in Iraq under very, very dramatic circumstances. Both of them were adopted by an Australian mother. And these kids, they have physical challenges, let's put it this way. And anybody who finds X Factor and looks at a kid from Iraq or adopted from Iraq will find him, and I don't want to go further on that because I'm not sure what he would want me to do on that. But he is a reasonably famous guy, so people know about him. He has physical challenges galore. He has done more for us to understand Iraq and to feel close to it while being there at Coronado Island than any official diplomacy I know of. So the role, again, of official channels of communication are going down. And us being informal and exchanging things with each other is going more and more and more important. But then the question is, what's in it for us? How does it touch us? How does it touch our lives, other than the fact that we understand each other? So what has been happening in Egypt right now, or some time ago, actually right now, about three of my Ukrainian relatives are actually spending their time at the resort in Egypt, and they are not very much preoccupied with political repercussions of what has been happening. But going back to what you were saying, is it's important to understand how much we Americans inadvertently influenced them, and our values got exported, not in a forceful way, but in a very natural way, that people wanted to have personal freedom of choice. And this is the influence America has on the world galore. It is difficult to even evaluate correctly what influence America is on the world in this respect. So that's what I think about Egypt, and that's what I think about political channels of communication and so-called grassroots diplomacy, which is the most important kind of diplomacy today, and leads to us working together.
Well, you know, it occurs to me how careful we as Americans probably, I'm going to say should be, and I'm not even sure that that's a fair statement, but, you know, we have a responsibility when we are, you know, showing what freedom looks like and how it, you know, other countries or other people, I'm assuming, maybe I'm making a broad assumption here, but I assume that people want to be free. As an American, I'm pretty sure that everyone wants to be free. Is that true? It must be true.
It is. And that leads me, telling you a little bit, and telling whoever wants to listen about it a little bit, how I got interested in this question of whether people are similar or different.
Right.
And therefore, the question of cultures and how I even understood that it was a significant question for me. When I was growing up, I was in the Soviet Union, and I lived in Ukraine, Odessa. And you, again, let's remind people, you lived 45 minute flight away from me. And we might as well have been living in different galaxies. And I remember very well, my father would come back home, and he would go straight to the kitchen, close the door, and he would be talking to my mother secretly. He was a military man. And I would only hear bits and pieces of our conversation. And I would hear the word, Americans, America, Americans, America. And I was asking myself a question, who is this America? Who are these Americans? This is what they do. This is what they do well. This is how they do things well. And I was thinking, why don't we just go and learn what they do well, and why they do things well, and what is it in them that makes them so genius? I thought I was the only one having that question. And then, fast forward several decades, I'm in the United States, and I'm hosting my first high-level political delegation. Actually, it was the ambassador of the Russian Federation in the United States. And the first question I hear is, when they deplaned, and I took them to a couple of places in Utah, and I specifically wanted to take them to places in Utah because I wanted to show them America, which is not Washington, D.C. And I got the same question from their military attaché. Why are these Americans so successful? I almost fainted because I was so surprised. I thought I was the only one asking that question. After that, I heard that question again and again and again and again. And this question was modified in different ways. Some people would say, they're not educated. They're not as educated as we thought they would be. Why are they so successful? And so I thought, okay, are Americans people or are Americans success machines? And if they're success machines, do they ever cry? And if they cry, is the taste of their tears the same as mine? And so that was a question that I set out to explore. And I started going to Europe, and I started asking the same questions. Why do Italians look so elegant, even when they get out of bed? What is it in them that makes them so darn elegant? Because you would look at the judge, you would look at the policeman, you would look at the passerby, and they would be impossibly elegant. And I thought, what is it in them? And that's how I wanted to understand what is universal in humans and what is culturally different. And if it's culturally different, should I learn about it or should I forget about it? And if I want to learn something from them, how do I go about it? Do you think these are interesting questions? Do you think these are the questions you ever asked, or was I the only one because I grew up a 45-minute flight away from you?
Most definitely. Sure. Most definitely. Oh, absolutely. And, of course, you know, I watched a whole different lifestyle. I also lived in Iran. We lived in a compound, but it was still what my parents used to call on the economy. In other words, we were not on a post, on a American base or anything like that. We were out in what my mother always called it, living on the economy. So funny. But you know, so I saw everything that was going on. I saw, you know, beggars in the street, and I saw people that were wealthy, and not so many wealthy people, but we rented from a very wealthy man. That's, you know, we rented a beautiful apartment from somebody. I don't know, it's a very different thing when you're a child and you're seeing something that, you know, like in Iran for 3 years, and then you come back to the States for a while, and then we went to Turkey for 3 years, and we came back, and it's very, very different. You know, people walking around with food on big plaques on their top of their heads. You know, and that was the bread guy. It was Ekmek, the Ekmek guy. And he'd be yelling Ekmek, Ekmek. You know, and you'd run out and, you know, grab this wonderful, almost like a bagel kind of bread thing off of this man's head. You know, and I don't know. It was just different. And I almost feel sorry for people who don't get a chance to travel abroad and certainly live abroad, because you do start to ask questions. You know, I do think that most people, I'm guessing, are ethnocentric about their own country. You know, I think we have the best country. But I have to believe that you thought that about Russia, and that people in France think that about France, don't they? I mean, wouldn't you think that your country is the best? But you can say, I do like some things about America. You know, I'm sick about other people. I say everything's great about America with almost no exception. I mean, there's some things that get on my nerves, but you know what I'm saying? How does it all work out? Doesn't every country or every countryman think that about their country?
You know, it is an interesting question because I thought about exactly the same thing recently. And I actually came, because I wasn't telling you how I started thinking about it. I was watching a piece on on Luxembourg, which is a very, very small, I would say, an impossibly small country. And I was thinking, how do school children study there? I mean, it doesn't even have a language of its own. I mean, not that every country does, but that country doesn't. And what do they think? What is their national identity? And I was thinking, each one, when they grow up in a particular country or particular nation, of course, it becomes the center of their existence. On the other hand, let's talk about a different angle. When you were in Iran, and you could, how do people perceive you? Did you feel that they thought about you as an extraterrestrial who just landed on planet Earth and you were, you know, this species of another era or something of that nature? Because that's what we were thinking about you. And did I think that the Soviet Union was the best country in the world? You know what I think the irony is? That I think everybody else other than an American actually thinks differently. They love their country. They understand that it is their native land. But we all thought that America was the best country in the world, honestly.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's not for everybody. In other words, no, being an American is, I think, is very, very different, at least in this era, is very different from being anyone else. I really do.
Well, okay, so here's what I will say about that. Yes, I probably was considered, you know, an alien almost. I mean, I felt like it because every single day in first grade, the bus driver that came to pick me up tried to run me over every single day, tried to literally hit me with the bus. And my mother protected
really?
Me every single day. And it was a sport, okay, obviously. And, of course, I made it. I got on the bus, and, you know, I don't know why my mother even put me on that bus, but, you know, he tried every single day to run me over. So that's just an interesting story. But, yes, I was an alien. But kind of going a little bit further past what we were just talking about, I will never, ever feel like I do about America, about any other country. That I can guarantee you. But I am intrigued by some things in other countries. For example, I think Singapore has got something that we should try to figure out what they're doing right in terms of money, in terms of cleanliness in the streets, in terms of, you know, order, you know, among the citizenry, success, education. You know, there's some things going on that are pretty impressive when you study a little bit about Singapore. And I say, okay, what can I grab from that and sort of like bring home? Because I'm never going to want to live in Singapore or be from there, but I want to have some of what they've got going on. Is that kind of what's happening around the world, where you can say, okay, I'm going to pick a little bit out of Singapore, and, you know, I love the French for this and that. And, I mean, that's not a bad idea, is it?
No. In fact, I think it is the idea of the century, which is the idea of learning from each other. But I would like to go back and touch upon the differences in how we look at things. Look what you say. I think America is the best country, but I'm interested in other countries. And did you think the same when you were a Russian? And I would say, no, I didn't. I thought that I loved Russia, still love Russia. Russia is my own, but America is the country I want to live in, and Russia and America is my country. So I went through a different process of development. And then there is another thing. You know, it came as a revelation to me that when I was taking naturalization, I was going through a naturalization ceremony. Unlike you, I actually became a real American because I pledged my allegiance to my country. And, you know, I always laugh at Americans who are born in America. I say, you're not real people. You're just born here. I'm the one who pledged my allegiance. But in
right.
any case, at that moment, I understood that there is a fundamental difference in multicultural countries like the United States. I could be of Russian descent, and I'm an American. You're born in America, in the South, let's say, and you're an American nonetheless. But if you take France, it's still different. French live in America. Russians live in Russia. Italians live in Italy. And everybody who chose to become an American lives in America. Not that everybody can come. You know, the process is complicated. But nevertheless, America is a set of ideals. It's not a set of bloods or DNAs. Other countries are a set of DNAs. Do you see the fundamental difference of a national idea of America? That's why we, people from outside of the United States, we relate to America in a different way than we relate to other, than you, an American who is born in America. To us, America represents even a piece of us, a hope for us. I understand that it sounds like closet patriotism, but it is. It is. Every one of us who crossed the pond to become an American, or crossed the ocean to become an American, we do it for a reason. And America allows us to be that. And that's where the unifying principle of America is actually the beginning of globalization. So America is globalization in a, you know, let's say miniature globalization, because it showed how everybody starts interacting with everybody and learning from everybody. And you can see it in our restaurants here in the United States, at the food we eat, at the things we use. So should we learn now from other countries by all means and in a hurry, because we were so busy with ourselves that we forgot that globalization has been happening with ever-increasing speed since the fall of the Soviet Union? Actually, it started in the 70s, but very, very slowly. And real globalization started in 1992 and picked up speed after 9/11. Surprisingly, but just picked up speed, and it's an ever-increasing train. Now, what has been happening is the fact that people started finding communication with each other, separate, not going via United States, but using English, nonetheless, as an international language. And I would like, by the way, to touch upon the English language and how it's perceived in the world. It doesn't belong to America. We have a, let's say, universal version of English that all of us use, and it's neither British nor American, but it's ours. It's the language of our communication. For example, I have friends in Brazil. Which language do you speak? English. I have friends in Italy. Which language do I speak with them? Not Italian. I speak English. We all use English. Now, when you come to Dubai, for example, today, there are a lot of signs in Russian. Why? Because the number of Russian tourists is more than the number of American tourists there. And the number of business connections between Dubai and Russia is staggering. And we Americans don't even know about that. So there are a lot of alliances and new developments that are being born during the time of globalization that we Americans do not know about. They use English as the language, unification language. They use a little bit of Russian, a little bit of Arabic. But these are very, very different entities, and we Americans need to learn how to do that ourselves. We need to learn from them. And I am concerned that we are missing the train. That's number one. It's the train of globalization. How do we really globalize ourselves, and how do we go about it, especially when you're not a very large company? Because when we were, I worked for very large companies and helped them to globalize. And they do it very, very differently than an entrepreneur would do today. And we have opportunities to do so. And you're still there, Deborah, right? I have not lost you.
Oh, yes. No, I'm yes. enthralled. Well,
yeah.
I was going to go back a minute, if I could.
Yes, uh-huh.
What I realized as we're talking, I mean, I always, just my brain is always, you know, assessing what you're saying, putting it in its place for the next part of this conversation, but then kind of, you know, it trips another little trigger, and what I was thinking just now is how amazing it is. America is not a very old country, you know. It hasn't been around as long as the entrenched
centuries and centuries of generation after generation of people in other countries. You know, so it is an amazing country, really. It is a melting pot of all kinds of different ethnicities and cultures and wonderful things that have been brought from all around the world to create what we have here. And it's not just white Anglo-Saxon Protestant by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's just everything we could possibly want is at our fingertips, and some people just are not willing to look at it or analyze it or accept it, and certainly not use it to their benefit. Because we can use understanding of culture for our benefit, can we not?
We can and we should. In fact, we are left without any choices at the moment. We think, and by the way, it pertains to America more than it pertains to, to the rest of the countries, or to the rest of the cultures, I would say. And you know why? Precisely because of that reason that I stated when we just started this conversation. Remember what you said, and remember what I said. You said about you being an American that you cannot even imagine the country better than America. Is it the same for you, Taira? And Taira said that, no, it is not the same for me. When I was growing up in Russia, I did not think it was the best country. I knew America was the best country. So it was a different feeling. So you thought America was the best country, and I thought America was the best country. But we were from two different countries. It created a very different life for me, open to a lot of learning. I am concerned that Americans do not do the necessary learning that we are pressed to do, because they think they're already at the top of the Olympus, of Mount Olympus. And that is a very dangerous thought. Rooted in reality, yes, in previous reality, as a matter of fact, because it was, America was and still is an uncontested cultural leader in the world. But nevertheless, it's a very, very dangerous thing to sit on the Mount Olympus. We just need to remember what happened to ancient Greek mythology and how it got supplanted by a different culture that came in its place. So we are learning from America, but you are not learning from us. So it is not even a choice for us anymore. Yes.
Well, I was going to say, yes, we are at the top of the heap, but we are also, if we really start to assess, really do a checklist of where we are in terms of education and infrastructure and some other things, you know, longevity, healthcare, whatever, you really start looking at the numbers, and I don't know, what are we, number 23 in the world for education or something, and or math and science? I don't know. It's just, yes, we are top of the heap, but we have to earn that again in a way, and I don't know that all Americans are willing to see that we have some earning to do. You know what I'm saying? It's like, no, we're just going to hang out here because we are number one, and we're fine with that. Well, guess what? Somebody else can be number one, too, if we're not careful. Is that a fair statement?
It is a fair statement. And let me argue with parts of this statement. For example, we will not be number one if we're not careful. Actually, the concept of number oneness is very, very rapidly changing. And let me tell you how. Let me give you an example of a classroom that I teach. I teach graduate classes where I teach international business. And I have students from France, from Qatar, from Russia, from Iraq, and I forgot some other countries. And here are my Qatarian students making a presentation, and it turns out that it's a very, very little country, only about 500,000 people. It's not even less. I think it's even less. I cannot state the numbers correctly right now. And the per capita income is $85,000 a year for a very, very average family. In fact, that is their standard income. My American students couldn't believe it. Then, and it's a very, very small country. So what is number one? Is it your power? Is it your financial stature? Is it your cultural influence? Is it your business influence? You see, so the concept of number oneness changed forever. If you take Norway, Norway has a special government fund that covers security fund, as they call it, if I'm not mistaken, that actually covers the unexpected expenditures. Not only that country is not in the red, that country has a surplus, treasury surplus, that they can live for a year on if the economy is not doing well. So is that an achievement? And it's a very, very small country, very much in the north, no palm trees, no lazure, you know, seas and, you know, any conditions like that. No, but a very, very successful country, a country in its own right. So there are, what we Americans are thinking, we're very success-oriented. What we have, in my view, is pre-globalization idea of what constitutes success. Success
right.
in reality today is multiplicity of choices. That is what needs to sink through our thick skulls here in America so we become successful in multiple ways. Because we are very successful as a cultural leader, but we're very unsuccessful in many other areas. We previously were successful in every area. We stopped being that. And, by the way, I don't think it's bad. I happen to think that it is not bad at all. And let me show you how I came to that conclusion. Because I myself survived the destruction of a huge superpower that attempted to compete with the United States in one and one area only, which is nuclear weapon. And then it fell apart. And I remember I talked to top brass of nuclear weapon specialists in Russia, in the former Soviet Union, and I remember how crushed they felt that they lost that position in the world. And I said, no, you shouldn't be upset. That's okay. Let's develop in other areas. Let's let go of this particular area because that was not a constructive area anyways. So we Americans need to understand now where we do need to be constructively successful and where we don't need to even worry about that. And that is a huge choice for us because we started losing ground when we started sticking our nose. We don't belong at all and we don't need to be. And it empties our coffers, so to say. And that is not a good idea. So multiplicity of success is a new idea that comes from globalization, and it works inside of the country, inside of the United States. So if I may finish that thought, saying the following. New concepts of how to live, how to define success, how to define love, how to define relationships comes now from other countries because a universal idea of multiplicity is being formed. And we will pick and choose what works for us, and it gives us even more individual freedom. So in a sense, we need to become even more individualist in our personal choices than we were before. But we have to be very skillful about it. Otherwise, mass entertainment will eat us alive and give us a very, very, what would you say, cheap, cardboard, superficial version of what constitutes success, love, and happiness. You see?
Wow. Okay, so let's wrap back around for a second here. So when we were talking about that concept of one of number oneness in the beginning, I was writing down power, influence, wealth, you know, and I would say, okay, the United States has been, you know, in terms of number oneness, you know, power, influence, wealth, whatever, but it's not really necessarily true for an entire, for the entire spectrum of the population, clearly. But then when you talk about multiplicity of success, and I realize the tapestry of the American experience, you put everything together on this beautiful display board, you know, and you just realize what is all here for everybody to partake of pretty much at will. You know, you just have to want to and then step up and take your piece, you know, and earn it and use it and so forth. That multiplicity of success is actually, it's huge here.
Huge and... you're absolutely correct. And may I add to that, or you wanted to finish your thought?
Well, I was just going to say it seems boundless. In other words, the
everything that we have here, the way this country is, you know, if you've ever gone coast to coast and up both, you know, up both shores, it is amazing to behold the variety of not only people and things that are available to do and see, and the history that's here in various places and all that stuff, but just the weather patterns and the different terrain and all that stuff, and the beauty of going up, for example, the Pacific Coast is unbelievable. To go in, to get in your car and go from the top of the country down to the bottom, you know, in one car ride is unbelievable. I've done it a couple of times, and you cannot help but saying, God bless America. I mean, it's just gloriously beautiful. And I'm sure, well, of course, I've seen the Bosphorus, and I've seen some other things abroad, and it's equally beautiful. But my point is, it's all here for the taking, and yet I think people are just not paying attention to what all we have here. I just don't think they realize it. Americans don't realize it about our own country.
I hear what you say, and may I add to that and develop that thought further. Let's talk about the beauty of the country. America is a large country, no question about it, with a variety of scenery. Now, I myself originally come from a huge country, which can swallow a couple of Americas, a couple of the United States, the size of the country of the United States. So I'm so used to the variety of the terrain of incomprehensible variety that when I came to the United States, yes, I noted that the size of the country. And at the same time, I thought, oh, and I myself come from a very large country and have a concept and mentality of a citizen of a large country. And by the way, from this standpoint, Americans, Canadians, Brazilians, and Russians understand each other very, very well. Because Brazil, for example, is also a huge country in size. So the largest countries in the world are, number one, Russia, number two, Canada, number three, United States, and then Brazil, if I'm not mistaken. Again, I might be mistaken a little bit on statistics. But apart from all this, from the scenery, it is truly America created a particular concept. In fact, it started encapsulating globalization in itself without even knowing it before the age of globalization. That is why such a young country moved forward so, so quickly. So each one of us who either was born in America or came to America is free, as you very correctly said, to partake of the multiplicity of choices and multiplicity of everything that this country gives, because it is truly a new world. And I saw it immediately the moment I landed in the JFK Airport in New York by just sheer multitude of skin colors, honestly. For some reason, I later learned it presented a lot of friction inside of the United States. I understood the reasons why, but my first impression was these are lucky people that they have so many DNA choices and so many scenery choices. And at the same time, now, do Americans use it or do Americans not use it? Actually, when you look at America from outside of the United States, and I do this exercise practically every year, when I cross the pond, land on the other side of the Atlantic, I look around, I'm thinking, oh, here I am, back in the old world. And there are many characteristic features of the old world. For example, one of them is that 50 years ago is something that is quaint and archaic in America. And it is yesterday, or it is even today, just a couple of hours ago, when you're in Europe. 14th century is about 1 week ago, you see? And it's a totally different temporal concept of how you live. But nevertheless, looking from outside in, you actually do see that Americans are a remarkably motivated nation. We, inside of the United States, sometimes think of ourselves as lazy. We, Europeans, now I'm siding with another part of my identity, we think about you as the quickest people we have ever seen in our lives. Honestly, and I think you are. In fact, I can testify to you, I've seen it many, many times and talked to many other Europeans, that the moment they cross the ocean, the time starts flowing much quicker when they land in the United States. Because time, and that's how I understood the time, is actually a very subjective matter. It is the construct of the culture. Because when you are in different cultures, you feel, sense and lives through time differently. And I would love to elaborate on that, but hopefully our future shows will be discussing different sense of timing and how it helps us to be more successful and switch from one sense of time to another, how a sense of relationships, how we switch from one mode to another. So to repeat your thought that we need to learn other cultures, it is a necessity for us. And do Americans take advantage? Inside of the country, I think we don't. But when I look at America from outside of the country, I repeat, I think Americans are very driven, very motivated, and very hardworking. I really do.
Well,
so I have a more positive view of how America is the moment I leave it.
Isn't that interesting? And I think I started to say something a minute ago and then got off track because I remember now I didn't say what I meant to say, and that is I do feel that we are responsible. And maybe everybody feels responsible, or maybe it's just me. But I feel responsible, and I think we should be responsible for how we act and how we show up so that we are, if not role models, it's certainly not a negative influence on the way the rest of the world is viewing how we should all be in terms of globalization and cultural multiplicity of success and all that stuff. See, I think we are responsible because we've taken such a visual role. I mean, you know, we're out there. We're not quiet. We're not sitting behind a wall. You know, we're in charge. We're large and in charge. And if we're not doing the right things, and if people are seeing, you know, bad behavior or, you know, greed and evil and you know, stupid MTV videos, and if that's the impression we're giving, we kind of touched on that last time, you know, that's not responsible. Does that make sense, or am I being way too concerned about how other people view us?
Well, actually, let me tell you, I cannot agree more with you. I'm so grateful to you that you think that way, and let me tell you why. Because, you know, when you're born into royalty, and in my view, very firm view, Americans, by virtue of being born in America, are born into royalty. A royalty basically does not have a choice but being a royalty. If royalty, if you are royalty and you do not represent your life or do not live your life in a certain way, that's why British royalty has been such a long-lasting phenomenon. It's because they ingrained in their loyalty, in their royalty, certain concepts of loyalty to their role, that you cannot violate your role. I think it was violated only once, and they still remember it. And remember, it was Prince Edward, if I'm not mistaken, and he became, or King Edward, who actually abdicated the throne because he was marrying an American citizen, and he
right.
had the royalty.
Wallace Simpson. Wallace Simpson was her name.
Yes, yes. Not to be mixed with Jessica Simpson, but that's beside the point. God bless Jessica Simpson as well. But what I'm saying is, if you're an American and you think you represent only yourself, well, think again. There is a price that comes with being born in such a powerful presence in the world. And let me tell you how people usually discover it. I remember very well, again, that we crossed the pond. We land in Europe because basically my major destination where I took many delegations was Europe, different countries in Europe. And we and Americans immediately start hearing such things at the reception. So why do you do this to us, to the rest of the world? Why did you invade Iraq? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And Americans say, well, how do I know? I mean, I'm just a person. No, you're not a person. You are representative of your culture, country, system, everything. For example, questions such as, how do you allow these immoral shows? Oh, I'm not Hollywood. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. They will hold you responsible to that because you embody your own culture. You embody your own country. And it invariably happens every time I took Americans abroad. In fact, after I became an American, now I became responsible, and I perform the function of a representative of America as well. So if you are born into such a powerful culture, you cannot not A, represent it correctly, B, not take advantage of it. That's why what you say is very correct. It echoes being an American. You say, why don't everybody take advantage of opportunities that America gives? We, from outside of the United States, we think that you do take advantage of opportunities, but when I put my American hat on, I say, no, not enough, not enough. You cannot be born in America, expect to be the first one in the world, and not represent it correctly. Let me give you even an example that illustrates it. I'm reading the book Abundance, that you, Peter Diamantis, is that the name of the author of the book?
Yes.
Abundance.
Yes.
He, on the first pages of the book, it said that if you were to compare living standards of Europeans, other countries, and Americans, the results look like this. In order for everybody to live according to European standard of life, you will have to have, if I'm not mistaken, two or three Earth globes to live on. If you want to emulate American standard of living, it will require five planet Earths. In other words, not enough. One planet Earth is not enough. You have an incomparably, we have an incomparably higher expectations or standard of living that even today, even with higher per capita income, other countries have. Let me tell you also how I discovered it. And that also links to the idea of multiplicity of success. When I was growing up in Russia, I thought that there is an idea of success, material success. You have a house, you have several bedrooms, you have several bathrooms. That was an impossible ideal of luxury. Then I come to the United States, and it turns out that everybody and their dog, not everybody and their dog, literally, but a critical mass of the population actually have it as a matter of course. And I thought, oh, so there is no pie idea of success. So it's not that you cut the pie and each one gets a little slice and some more, some less. When you come to America, all bets are off, and they all created an idea of success for everybody, achievable by practically everybody inside of
America. Well, wait a minute. Here's what we do. We just make a bigger pie. We just make
exactly.
a bigger pie. I mean, it's like, no. Wait a minute. You can have your slice, but I'm baking a bigger pie because I'm also having my slice. Isn't that amazing?
You're
just making
you
a bigger pie.
Exactly. And that is where the greatness of America and its role in globalization is. Because what every American carries and should carry, they don't carry it. That's it. They should be fired from being an American. They should be fired, and then they should be banished and say, you don't represent your culture, your country correctly. You were born here, and it's not a choice. You cannot make a choice to be a lousy American. You have
right.
to be a good American. So a good American carries these ideas and materializes these ideas for the benefit of the rest. What we are struggling with in America, we ourselves are struggling sometimes with the idea that the pie is limited. So we are trying to say, okay, you people move to the edges of the planet, and we're going to use everything because we're Americans, we're entitled. And the rest of the people say, you know what? Why is that? You are humans. We are humans. You cannot use our piece of the pie. And so we started arguing about the pie. And by the way, that's where when Americans lose, and lose again. When an American comes and represents himself correctly to the world and says, the pie is endless. Let me show to you how we in America created a larger pie for everybody. That's when he shines. When he shines everywhere, he or she. And that's when they create a different universe for others. And that's when real globalization happens for an American. You see? So an American, strictly speaking, cannot afford smallness of thinking. It's not his job description in the world. Like, you see, every culture actually does have their job description. And each culture needs to fulfill their job description. If the culture starts deviating from their job description, they start losing left and right. And in Qatar, for example, I saw it very clearly. They are very clearly trying, and this is what they're doing right, and that's where they're extremely successful. They are trying to preserve the preciousness of their culture through a different financial vehicle. And yet the authenticity of their culture, without being tainted by other influences, is a very important concept to them. And they are doing it wonderfully. You will never mix Qatar with Alabama or Arkansas or anything else. You could see that it's Qatar. It's a different culture. It's a monarchy. And it's a very harmonious monarchy. They like it. And it works for them. And they are not democratic the way we Americans understand democracy. So to each its own. So the best beauty of America. And yes, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, and I don't really want to go down the political, overly political for the last 10 minutes that we have for this show. But it's always amazing to me that we as Americans will say that everyone must be free and in a democratic government. I'm not so sure about that. Qatar is having just a fine time, you know, and if everybody's doing well and the median income is $85,000 a year, then why would we want to, not that we would, but why would we ever say, well, you know, they're not a democracy, so they're not as good as we are. You cannot do that. You know, that's what happens, I'm afraid, is that people make silly mistakes in cultural analysis in saying that kind of thing instead of go with what your job description is. Our job description is not to decide that Qatar should be a democracy. That's not our job description. But the other thing I wanted to say is that there's something that I believe that the Kennedy family felt very strongly and still does, and it has, and many people of great wealth, I think, feel this, and that is something like, unto those given so much, much is expected in return. And that's why, you know, a lot of people that have that kind of wealth feel like they have to give back, whether it be in politics or Special Olympics in the case of the Kennedys or whatever. My point is, we have, as Americans, you're exactly right, we do have a price that we really do need to consider paying back for being blessed by being born an American. I believe that with all of my heart.
We are responsible.
We are responsible.
Exactly. You cannot be born an American and afford yourself a luxury of, A, being unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot afford it. You're not allowed. You have to be. Because the system, the structure, you were born into a particular culture that allows you to do that. Secondly,
right,
you were absolutely correctly pointed out that the greatness of America at the time of globalization is not to dominate others, it's to show to others the best ideals of life. And one of the ideals, it's incredible generosity of America's wealth. And, for example, let me tell you what America carries into the world. When I first came to the United States, I would sometimes see a white parent with a black child. And I could see that the child is of a different race, and it would turn out, I would ask, and I would turn out that the child was adopted. And I thought, this is a marvelous example. By the way, America thinks that it does struggle with a race issue, and it probably does. I myself see it from a different angle altogether. I'm thinking, don't they see what they have done? Like, for example, let me even backtrack and say, I clearly saw that America as it is today has been clearly created by black influences from Africa and white influences of Protestant origin. And that created a blend, and a very, 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 very impressive blend that is America today. So when I was looking at such parents, I was thinking, isn't it amazing? If I were to go back to Russia today and I would say that such a thing is happening, they would not even believe that it was possible. So America, in my view, shows concepts of generosity to the rest of the world. That's what America does extremely well. In personal generosity, I must say, because that's how this culture functions, and I would like to delve into that if it's ever interesting for us to do so. And by the concept of equality, which overtakes whatever negative influences there were in the country, like racism, for example, which obviously I myself did not know about it, I repeat. But when I came, I understood that it was a painful, and still is a painful issue. Not for me, not the way I see America today. I see a very honest country trying to do the best they can with moving things forward. Now, the question, the only question for us, the danger is that, A, we will not understand the beauty of our culture and express it fully, and we'll go down the sewage, so to say, and express a very pedestrian version of America, which kills us in the world today, and that we will not learn from others as quickly as we possibly need to learn. And I would like us to discuss it next time if we can.
Absolutely. And the other thing to keep in mind, I think, on pretty much all of our calls, all of our shows, rather, is that it really is such a small world. And we're all in it together. And I know that you love the idea of exploring the way to build a global family, you know, to really have people understand each other, have more respect and consideration amongst cultures, and just really being able to say, this is what I like about this culture, I'm going to bring that into my life, and this is what I like about that culture, I'm going to bring it into my life. And we have access to understanding all of it because of, frankly, technology and the fact that we can actually travel and then have things come to us via television and videos and, good gosh, this show, you know, and the fact that we're going to actually be talking to people when you're abroad, I am very excited about that. So this is just a lot of fun for me. I hope it is for you, too.
Oh, let me tell you. I mean, I never knew in my previous incarnation, so to say, even American incarnation, I could not express these views freely. I had a job description. I had to stick to my job description in Washington, D.C., and I was very good at those job descriptions, but it did not allow me to express the beauty of America and the heart of America the way I always wanted to express. You see, as a very newly born American, actually on the 10th of March, it was the 20th anniversary when I crossed the border of the United States. It's 20 years is long in a span of a human life, but it's just a moment in the history of the country. Of course, not American history, because American history has a different timetable. But I would say, yes, very, very excited. But I would like to underscore what you said, that we are exploring how to build a global family. Not only when you learn to understand each other, but by virtue of understanding each other, you actually make yourself successful, because we are a saturated society materially in the United States. We have to figure out what are our new markets? What would people want to buy from us? How do we excel outside of the United States? In what venues do we excel outside of the United States? How can we be a better version of ourselves and thereby become more competitive inside of the United States? What will make us better? What will make our lives better? And I would like to explore it, like different sense of time, different sense of food, different sense of taking care of yourself physically. That's where we can learn from other cultures a lot.
Well, I think that's great, and I know that we will take notes. I was grabbing notes as you were saying that. I know we will go back and listen later and make that list, because that sounds like a great show for next time. And also, it's very well encapsulated in the following. Success breeds success, and we might as well figure out what is being successful, what does that look like in other cultures, and gather that all to our bosom and say, you know what, I too shall be as successful as possible, not only in my culture, but in my entire nation or whatever. Whoever is with me will be successful, because that's the game we're playing, and we're going to play big. That's my goal. We're playing big, and we're playing Go Global Fast. So,
and it can be done fast. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think that's the great thing. It's a small world, and we can do it quickly. That's Americans love quick. That's too funny. I'm all over. Yeah, let's do it fast. So, mm-hmm. So it's great. All right. Well, I just think this has been an amazing amount of information to literally fly through. And I've got 6 pages of notes again. I don't know if anybody else takes notes while they're talking to you like I do, but my goodness. And here we are doing a radio show together, and I'm like, I'm in class, you know. Oh, my gosh, look at what she just said. So it's pretty funny. And I could just listen to it later and take my notes, but I do appreciate you, and I appreciate all of the insight that you bring. And, frankly, it's good news. You know, when I am as proud of being an American as I am, which I most certainly, that is one of my claims to fame, as I am a very proud American, But I do feel like a responsible American, and I'm glad that that's the right way to be as far as you're concerned. I think that's cool.
Yes, and I'm trying to be a responsible American. So one responsible
American. You are. You absolutely are. Well, then why don't we say our goodbyes for the moment, and we will be back with another show next week. Tyera, this was absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for all of the sharing and observations, and I don't know, I just feel more successful just having this conversation, don't you?
I do, and especially the fact that we collaborate. One American with a Russian accent, another American with, what's your accent again?
Well, I don't know. I'm technically from the South, but I've never really lived in the South. My parents were from the South, so I don't really have a Southern accent, but I can slip into one if that seems right. But no, I'm just a global girl. That's all it is to it. Right now I'm actually in Little Rock, Arkansas. So.
Oh, Little Rock.
All right.
Okay. We all know Little
Rock,
Arkansas. Please have a good day.
Okay. Well, you too. So Pete, take us out. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye. Yes.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Go Global Fast with Dr. Tyera Kovaleva and Deborah Brown. Tune in every Monday for another hour of globalization success strategies. Go Global Fast is a production of the Boomer and the Babe Incorporated. Contact them at boomerandthebabe.com.